The publication of the Pentagon Papers, an internal top-secret chronicle of America's conduct of the Vietnam War, is having a new moment. This past fall, in their sprawling 10-part documentary of the war, filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novick explored the impact of the New York Times' reporting on the leaked papers in 1971.
7,000 pages of highly classified documents and historical narrative, compiled secretly at the orders of former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. He had hoped a study of the decision-making process that had led the United States to become so deeply involved in Vietnam would help future policymakers avoid similar errors.
There were plenty of those. But even more damning, the Times found evidence within the Pentagon Papers that the White House had lied to Congress and the public about their agendas in Southeast Asia for more than 30 years. Fearing the coverage would turn more Americans against the war and threaten troops on the ground, the Nixon White House got a legal injunction to block the Times from further reporting on the papers until the Supreme Court weighed in. Steven Spielberg's new film, The Post, released nationally this weekend, tells the lesser-known tale of the Washington Post's decision to publish more on the Pentagon Papers now that the Times was barred.
If you publish, we'll be at the Supreme Court next week.
Meaning?
Well, we could all go to prison.
The film, starring Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, is a throwback to the distant time when our country still recognized and celebrated journalism. Yet Les Gelb isn't so sure the press got the meaning of the Pentagon Papers right, then or today. And he led the team that researched and wrote them 50 years ago. He says he rarely gets to set the record straight because chroniclers, they don't pick up the phone.
The people behind the movie The Post didn't call. The only one who came by, really, was Ken Burns for his documentary on Vietnam.
What did he ask you?
He asked me about the origins of the Pentagon Papers, and I told him what they were, namely that we got a list from McNamara of 100 questions, and about 90, 92 of them were current questions, the kind of questions that the press secretary would be asked on a daily basis.
Things like what's happening in the field, how many of the enemy died.
That's right, what's the body kill, things like that. Exactly the kind of questions the press secretary answered every day. And about 8 of the 100 questions were historical, like, could Ho Chi Minh have been an Asian Tito, like the ruler of Yugoslavia? Mm-hmm. Or what was Diem like when we first started to support him? There were a bunch of questions like that. And I was given 6 people from the building to work on these questions, and we were given 2 months to get them done. And I collected the people. By the way, we were told not to tell anybody about this. We stared at the questions. We all started laughing. They said, well, why are we doing this? This is the kind of stuff we send up to the press secretary when we're preparing him to answer questions. And we're not going to be able to add anything to what we're doing on a daily basis.
But some of the questions were bigger than that, Les. You wrote in an article in the New York Times that the questions included, are we lying about the number killed in action?
Yeah.
Can we win this war?
Yes, and those were the daily questions.
Real answers to those questions would take a lot more than a soundbite from a press secretary.
Well, we were giving what we thought were the real answers to the questions when we did the press guidance for the press secretary. You know, we didn't know more than we were providing on a daily basis as it was.
So how did the government feel about the war when McNamara asked you these questions?
I would say almost everybody in the government felt that the war was not going well. But a number felt there were ways to fight it better, to do the pacification program better, to do the military exercises there better. But there were very, very few people, Brooke, in the Pentagon or the State Department or the White House who were flat out against the war.
Right. They believed in what is known as the domino theory.
Essentially, that was it. The foreign policy people, those who gravitated to work on Vietnam, were all brought up in that tradition of the domino theory, that somehow if we lost a strategic place such as Berlin, we would lose Europe. And in fact, in one of the memos you'll see in the Pentagon Papers, the State Department referred to Indochina as the Asian Berlin. That's how central they thought it was to the future security and safety of the United States. Hard to believe, but that was the case. That's what we thought.
But why did McNamara ask you these questions if you were already given the best answers you could to the press secretary every day? Why?
I hate to give you this answer, Brooke, but to this day, I don't know. McNamara initially just said, answer those questions. Then after this group of six that I had assembled schmoozed about it for several days, we decided, well, you know, it might be interesting if we could look back into the files and maybe give more in-depth answers to the questions we had been answering more or less from our daily experience. And inevitably, in order to have more depth to answering the current questions, you had to dip back into the history of the pacification program, the history of who we were supporting in South Vietnam and so forth, which we did. And we wrote up a list of about 20-some-odd monographs.
Short papers.
Very short papers. That's really what the Pentagon Papers is, a bunch of short papers. And I sent the memo to McNamara, saying, here's the list of things. When we answer, when we provide these monographs, we'll be able to answer the questions more in depth. And he wrote on that memo, okay, let it be encyclopedic and let the chips fall where they may. But we were still enjoined from telling people about it. So the only ones who really knew were CIA, because McNamara called the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, told him we were doing this, and Helms shipped over to me an enormous quantity of these documents from the CIA. But he never called Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State. He never called Walt Rostow, the National Security Advisor, or told Lyndon Johnson. So I scrounged up some papers from those places on a personal basis. But the notion that we had access to everything under the sun and this was a definitive history is just plain wrong, Brooke, because we didn't have that kind of access and we never were allowed to do any interviews.
So give me an example of some of the more significant short papers that made up the Pentagon Papers.
There were papers about the initial involvement, it was a monograph about the initial involvement in Vietnam, about Ho Chi Minh writing letters to Harry Truman. And interestingly, I just have to tell you this, Brooke. Interestingly, when the CIA gave me those letters, they were the original letters in French. So I thought to myself, well, what is the CIA doing with those letters? Weren't they given to Harry Truman? I didn't know whether they ever really were. And there's nothing in Truman's memoirs to say that he received them.
Are you suggesting that there is at least a possibility that those letters were intercepted before they made it to Truman?
Well, they were given to the OSS operative in Vietnam.
Which is the precursor organization to the CIA.
Of the CIA, exactly. And he sent them into the OSS in Washington.
Wow.
And they were in the CIA files.
Amazing.
I know.
And you were a 30-year-old punk, pretty much, right?
I was 30 years old. I was director of policy planning in the Pentagon. That was my regular job.
And your direct boss was a guy named John McNaughton, who was one of McNamara's closest advisors.
That's right.
He was killed in a plane crash shortly after they came up with the 100 questions, right?
That's right. It was McNaughton and McNamara who wrote up those 100 questions.
But it was your team of a half dozen people who came up with the idea of writing these short papers, which became the Pentagon Papers. It wasn't commissioned by McNamara. It was your guy's response to the 100 questions.
Yeah, that's how we figured out to make it useful. And then he okayed it.
Ken Burns suggested. It's also suggested in the new film, The Post, that McNamara commissioned this study as a cautionary tale for those who might follow in his footsteps. And so what do you think of that narrative?
I think it's an explanation that Bob McNamara came up with after the fact.
Uh-huh.
And he told some people that he was doing this to save future leaders from making the same mistakes. And he told others who didn't like it. For example, he told Dean Rusk that he never asked for these studies. He just wanted a collection of documents.
How long did it take to complete?
Oh, a little over a year and a quarter. Started in June of 67, finished in February 69. And when it was all done, you know, we had these 36 volumes,
mm-hmm.
which very few people who have written about the Pentagon Papers, I assure you, have read. And then I took the papers over to McNamara's office at the World Bank. He was head of the World Bank in February 69.
All the volumes? How'd you get them there?
Yeah, a sergeant who was still working on the papers carried them over.
On a dolly?
Fit in two boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Each monograph was, I don't remember exactly, mm-hmm. but 30 to 50 pages long or something
uh-huh.
like that. So I brought him into his office, and we're sitting around this coffee table and having a little chat. And then finally I said to him, would you like to see the papers? And he said, okay. And I opened up one of the boxes, and I handed him one of the monographs. He flipped through it like you flip through a deck of cards with his thumb, and he threw it back into the box. And he said, and I quote, take them back to the Pentagon.
Do you think he ever read them?
I have no idea. I spoke to him many times over the years, and I never asked him, and he never said.
McNamara left. He was replaced by the lawyer, Clark Clifford, as a Secretary of Defense, a very sort of blue-blood lawyer who had virtually no foreign policy experience, right?
That's right. He wasn't a foreign policy nick like those of us who had been involved in Vietnam policy for years. And by the way, we thought Clifford was sent to the Pentagon by Johnson to sit on people like us who had begun to ask questions about the war that the White House didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't against the war, but we were asking questions. And Clark Clifford sensed this right away and laughed and said, realize I've been against this war since 1965.
What did he think of the domino theory?
Well, that was the reason why he became a dove in 65, long before the rest of us foreign policy experts were still caught in the trap of our thinking. Johnson had sent him to Asia to talk to the Asian leaders about sending more troops to Vietnam to fight the war. And none of them would give any troops. And so Clifford, as he's telling the story, said, I thought to myself, well, if the dominoes don't think they have to fight to save themselves, what the devil are we doing?
By the time you were assembling what became the Pentagon Papers, it was already known to the Secretary of Defense and to the President, and possibly to you, if you were sending that information daily to the press secretary, that the war was not going to be won.
Yeah, well, there were some people who thought it could be won.
Not the president and not the Secretary of Defense.
That's correct.
So the deciders on this war believed, understood, recognized that it couldn't be won, and yet they felt they had to continue to send wave after wave and battalion after battalion into the field to die.
That was true of some of these people. There's no question about it. But I think Walt Rostow and Dean Rusk continued to believe that we still could pull this out.
Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State.
Secretary of State. Walt Rostow was the National Security Advisor. But, I think most people by sometime in 68, came more to believe that we couldn't afford to lose and to figure out how to make that at least costly as possible.
So knowing that the war wasn't winnable, they continued to send soldiers into it.
Not to lose.
To not lose.
That's right.
This is a point that comes up in the post. So in the movie, you see Catherine Graham, played by Meryl Streep, talk to the McNamara character. Graham and McNamara were close friends, and looks at him reproachfully because her kid and other people's kids were being sent to fight in a war which she realizes from the Pentagon Papers he knew at the very time that McNamara knew the war couldn't be won, just as a sort of a move to maintain a strange balance of power in the world, a bankrupt notion, as it later came to be believed, called the domino theory.
As it came to be believed later. But at the time, most people in government believed it, Brooke. I know it's hard to think of as something serious because the story has been put out that the Pentagon Papers showed they were all lying. But while the papers show some lies, the main message of those papers is that our leaders who were making decisions about Vietnam and Indochina for all those years, from Truman onwards, didn't know hardly anything about Vietnam and Indochina. They were ignorant. And it also shows that the people who were working on Vietnam, the foreign policy community, believed in the domino theory, that if we lost Vietnam, the rest of Asia would fall. And that was kind of a given. Here we're talking about all this stuff, and you know far more than the average informed person about the Pentagon Papers, and you're surprised by my answers.
That's precisely why we called you, Les, because there are national stories, legends about the Pentagon Papers, and you think that they convey a false narrative. Now, you concede there was an enormous amount of lying, constant statements of optimism by officials like McNamara long after he'd ceased to feel any optimism about winning the war. There was the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which allowed Johnson to escalate America's role in the war, and much of that is based on a lie.
Yeah, I didn't even know that, Brooke, by the way, on the Tonkin Gulf until I saw the actual negatives of the pictures taken during the shooting in Tonkin Gulf.
Would you contrast what the story was we were told and what you saw?
Yeah. What the American people were told in 1964 was that North Vietnamese boats attacked American ships in the Tonkin Gulf area and that our ships fired back in protection.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found out when I actually saw the negatives of the pictures taken during that night. These were negatives that showed our ships firing huge guns and no evidence of any small ships firing guns at us. I was astonished.
Confusion in the Gulf of Tonkin initially, and later outright deception, enabled President Johnson to affect a huge escalation in America's participation in that war. It was that aggression that created the foundation for it.
That's right. It provided the public justification.
I would argue that you may underestimate the significance of the more or less continuous lying all throughout the conduct of that war.
I don't think I underestimate the lying. I was witness to it. I know what it was, and I know who was doing it.
But you think the media narrative about it is outsized?
I think it's outsized based on the Pentagon Papers, Brooke. And if you read the papers, you know, Ellsberg created the myth that what the papers show is that it all was a bunch of lies. But the truth is, as I've said, people actually believed in the war and were ignorant about what could and could not actually be done to do well in that war. That's what you see when you actually read the papers as opposed to talk about the papers.
So essentially, what you see are decades and decades of ignorance or an unwillingness to recognize the real nature of the foe you're opposing, and adherence to a set of beliefs that forced the government in a position where it had to continue to sacrifice thousands of men for a war it knew it couldn't be won in order to gain breathing space to get the enemy to the table, maybe.
That's right. And it took a long time to get the North Vietnamese to the table. It was very hard. And, you know, when it started, at the end of 68, we sat down and we mostly were arguing about the shape of the table and who was going to sit there. And Dixon negotiated for another 4 years or so before he concluded the deal.
And how many people died in that period?
As many as died in all the years before. You know, the total, I think, is something like 58,000 deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And God knows how many lives ruined.
And of course, we're talking about American casualties. It may be as many as 1 or 2 million Vietnamese.
Oh, yes.
You wrote in the New York Times back in 2001, you said, almost all the, quote, doves I knew became doves far later than they remember. Even into early 1969, the doves in the government were not arguing for complete withdrawal. Rather, we argued for stopping the bombing, serious negotiation, the beginning of a gradual withdrawal of troops. Even then, you wrote, our opposition wasn't really based on moral grounds. We were all hard-nosed national security analysts, and we began to question the war because it looked like a stalemate that would seriously affect our position as a great power around the world.
Also because it was tearing our country apart, and that became a factor in our thinking as well. But it started in 68, and it changed gradually. You know, we were all brought up in this view about the Cold War. Well, that's what America was like. And Congress, the great majority in Congress, backed the war year after year for just those reasons as well. And look, I wish I had turned against the war much sooner. And I regret it. You have no idea. But eventually I did, and then I spent several years of my life fighting against the Nixon policy and for the early end of the war. But it was too late.
So how did you feel back in 1971 when you discovered that the New York Times was about to publish the Pentagon Papers?
Well, that's a very good question because, to be perfectly frank, as I think I've been throughout this this interview, I was of mixed emotions about the publication of the papers because my first instinct was that if they came out this way, they just hit the papers, that people would misunderstand what they were. They would think this was the definitive history of the war, which, as I've explained, they were not. They weren't complete documents from the government. There were no interviews. And that people would think it was all about lying rather than beliefs. And look, because we never learned that darn lesson about believing our way into these wars, we went into Afghanistan and we went into Iraq out of these foreign policy beliefs. Fortunately, I learned my lesson in Vietnam, but a lot of people didn't.
And do you think that's why it's important to clarify what the real lesson of the Pentagon Papers is?
Absolutely. You know, we get involved in these wars in places like Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria, we don't know a damn thing about those countries, the culture, the history, the politics, the people, particularly the people on top, and even down below. They don't learn about this in the schools. Most of those Middle Eastern institutes have disappeared, and our expertise doesn't come up from the universities anymore the way it did many, many years ago. And the leadership has no knowledge about those countries at all. And they go send troops there to fight. They spend American dollars and lives in countries they know nothing about. And my heavens, that was a central lesson I felt about Vietnam.
But isn't it ironic that so much trouble to get those papers out there, they've been available for the public to read for a very long time, It's a big investment, needless to say. But you say so many of the specialists who talk about it themselves haven't read them very carefully. So right. We were unable to absorb the lessons after all.
I think so, because look, we committed the same kinds of mistakes in Afghanistan and Iraq and in Syria, getting involved in wars where we didn't know the country that we were committing to fight in. And that's essential in fighting wars. These are not, you know, wars like World War II and World War I. We have battalions fighting battalions and armies fighting armies. These are wars that depend on knowledge of who the people are, what the country is like, what the culture is like. And we jumped into them without knowing. That's the damn essential message of the Pentagon Papers. And look, it was nothing I came to all by myself. We had about 30-some-odd people working on those papers. A little more than half were military. Others were people from think tanks. And they essentially did the papers themselves. I went over them, making sure they weren't sticking in personal opinions. And almost all of them came to exactly the conclusions I'm telling you.
Go ahead and say it again.
The conclusions that we got into this war through a combination of ignorance about Vietnam and Indochina. We knew nothing about the people and the culture and the history. And we got in not because of Vietnam itself, but because Vietnam represented a domino in our strategic thinking, that if we lost there, we would lose all over Asia.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, when you think about these things that we learn about our government in how it conducts itself in the world, what we could have learned about our government's conduct of the Vietnam War, what later we could have drawn from declassified material from the Cuban Missile Crisis, the idea that we stared down the Russians, we learned, was never the case, that there were great compromises and deal-making behind the scenes that helped to prevent a nuclear war. So we have the material, we have the history, and yet in our public narratives, we still seem to draw lessons that are off the point, you feel, in the case of the Pentagon Papers, or the exact opposite of what really transpired in the case of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
That's because the people don't study the history. In the case of Cuba, you're exactly right. What happened there is the Russians took their missiles out of Cuba, but we also agreed secretly to take our missiles out of Turkey. And the Russians, in fact, kept that a secret, you know, for 10, 15 years. Why they did is a mystery to me. But most people had no idea that we gave as well as we got.
Les, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Yeah, this is, it's so hard for people to swallow all this, Brooke, because of all these years of hearing the other story, which, you know, again, I don't deny the lies. I just want them to understand what the main points really were.
Les Gelb led the team that wrote the Pentagon Papers. He's also a former columnist and correspondent for the New York Times and former head of the Council on Foreign Relations. Coming up on the big show this week, Bob speaks with Michael Wolff, author of the controversial book Fire and Fury about the Trump White House. So tune in this weekend. And as ever, run, don't walk, to sign up for our weekly newsletter at onthemedia.org.